and welcome to the August 2025 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. This month, we will start with part two of John Townsend's conversation with Roland Burrows, followed by Roland's choice of music. Fran Frank has put together a fresh batch of 10 quiz questions, so be ready to get those grey cells going. The answers will appear towards the end of the programme. David Picton will share his poem entitled Regrets. Norma Orty has a heartwarming story entitled Astray. I'll tempt your sweet tooth with a quick summer cake recipe from this month's Holcombe newsletter. Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor will be discussing the book Burning Bright by Tracy Chevalier, a title which may or may not describe your barbecue last weekend. Jeannie Lloyd-Jacob will be sharing another episode of This and That. We'll then listen to Jet the Scooter, a poem by Annie White, read by Sue Smallwood. This will be followed by Viv Wilson's One Foot in the Past, where she will be talking about the life of the first Baronet of Tynmouth. Fran Frank will be back with the answers to the quiz questions. Miggy Picton will make an announcement about the monthly VIP book group that meets at Dawlish Library, and then David Quay will take us on another transport-themed journey with the mysterious instruction to hold very tight, please. We will conclude the programme with a classic comic song. Here is John Townsend with his guest.
Hello, it's John Townsend again with the second part of my talk on the Performing Arts Devon Dialogue section with Roland Burrows, who was telling us earlier how he got into theatre by really, well, I think he thought it was cool to become a drama student and train as a as a drama teacher, which you then did. And I suppose, was your first job in a secondary school teaching drama?
It was exactly that, yes. It was in Marlow in Buckinghamshire.
Oh, right.
And I was only there, actually, for two terms. You're not supposed to move schools during your probationary year, but the county drama advisor wanted me in the county town for a big project that was going on. So
you were headhunted.
I was headhunted.
Yes, brilliant.
Worked with a very inspirational group of people. One had come down from the Belgrade Theatre, I think it was, in Leicester. Yeah. He was putting together, and I helped him form a theatre and education group.
Yes,
and
that's when there was money for
schools.
It.
Well, yes. Yeah. And we did some very serious pro-am productions. That was my first time of... I was being paid by then, obviously, as an actor teacher, and my acting was being funded. Yeah,
yeah, what a fantastic job. Yeah. So tell us one or two of the productions what they were.
We did Lion in Winter.
Oh, yes.
I understudied that one because I'd only just joined them and things were already on the go. They were in rehearsal for that. Mm. I understudied, but I did do the school's days because the guy playing King Philip, it must have been, couldn't do the daytimes because he had a job.
Yeah,
we had some of the best of professional and amateurs in the area. Mm. That's how that went. So I did the school's performances. I think we did two or three big audiences in the county borough assembly hall. I think there were something like 1,200.
Really? That's a lot.
Massive.
And did you project, presumably? You didn't have mics.
Well, the kids certainly did. The noise that hits you when you go out and there's 1,200 youngsters out there shuffling around, and I won't say hissing and booing, it wasn't quite that bad, but the teachers kept them in check.
Of all the roles that you've played over the years, do you have a favourite that you performed?
Back at university, I played Marlowe in She Stoops to Conquer.
Oh, right.
And I loved that because the woman, I think she was called Mrs. Hardcastle, but anyway, I ended up dating her afterwards. So that was a part that I actually loved for many, many reasons. But no, it's two parts. It's he's this upper class, very wealthy young man who gets tongue-tied in female company. But when he's in the pub and thinks he's chatting to barmaids and there's this sort of common approach. He changes his voice and becomes much more relaxed and at ease.
Right.
And so it's almost two parts in one.
Yeah. So that was quite fun to play. Yeah.
It was a big part, a lot of lines.
And you moving on, doing directing drama. I spoke earlier. You've been directing in this area. Was that your first one, The Bear?
The Bear. Well, I haven't done theatre for a long time, partly because I've done other work. Television directing is quite different
what was,
to theatre.
Yeah. Was that drama or more?
No. It was. It's funny. I got into it through having an idea of making the video brochure. So I set up a company, and a friend of myself made loads for travel agents. Mm-hmm. And travel agents would then hire them out and would show them in their shop windows and things back in the day. And we traveled all over Europe making travel films, basically.
But that's a steep learning curve, isn't it? I mean, was that something you had
from a classroom?
Yeah.
I was, again, very, very fortunate that at university and then in the county I was in, they had a CCTV unit.
Ah.
And so we learnt the basics of filming and editing and so on.
Quite a craft, I would imagine.
Put it into practice.
It
was quite scary going in and sitting in a professional edit suite with a professional editor, not knowing or not having a clue what all the buttons were for and what they did. Yeah. Fortunately, I got a grip and sat and thought, this guy knows what he's doing. All I've got to do is be very clear about what I want out of it and let him put it all together, which is the way it should be, in a sense.
Do you think you inherited your father's eye? You said he was an artist and a drawer. Because directing is very visual, isn't it? You've got to have a clear idea of what
you're... I think my theatre days, if you think about the old proscenium arch of looking at curtains either side and so on, a television screen for me is very similar. Mm. It's like a box. And a camera moves across that scene in the way that actors move across a scene on the stage. Yes. The lights pick them out. The camera zooms in. It's a very similar sort of thing visually.
Yeah.
I mean, technically, you've got so much more to worry about in television.
You say you've written a lot of pieces of drama and also, but you, coming on to your memoir, why did you write your memoir, Roland?
Oh, well... It came to me when I lost my mother in 2013. Dad had gone a few years earlier. And I realized that nobody knew anything about that first 30 years of my life. There was nobody left.
No.
I have no uncles or aunties, no brothers and sisters. Oh. Dad came from a big family, but they were much older than him. They'd all gone. He was 91 when he went. So there were none of them left. And I thought, there's nobody out there that knows anything about my... And who will my children speak to? They haven't got aunts and uncles.
No.
You know, so I thought I'd start to write it down and then I'd tell people about it. And they said, oh, that's a great story. And then I'd embellish it because they'd ask me questions. And I thought, there's a lot here. I could make something
of it. I've seen you at the book fair in Tynmouth, flogging your wares. I don't know if I can ask this, but I might persuade you, perhaps in subsequent programs, to give us a little snippet here and there. Can I ask you to do that?
Yeah. Arm behind his back. No, happy to. Happy.
We might
sell
a few
from life. Well, that would be nice.
Well, I'm going to have to... I mean, a lot more we could talk about, but perhaps we'll hear about a lot more when you tell us, read from your book. But
okay.
Let's just have a bit of fun to finish with. If I cast you on a desert island... What would you choose as your luxury, Roland?
Well, I'm afraid my luxury, my first thought goes to alcohol, but that's not very becoming, is it, really? I think it would be an espresso machine. I start my day with a double espresso. So
a coffee-holic.
Sort of.
What about, I won't do a book, what about a film?
Well, I've recently seen, I don't want to plug somebody else's wares, but I've recently seen the film, what was it called? Better Man, about Robbie Williams.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
And that was extraordinary.
Is that played by a chimpanzee?
It's
or something.
You there's could a, be excused for thinking that. Yeah, it's CGI, I think, but it's really brilliantly done. But it's multi-layered, and it's so much more than that.
Yeah, okay.
And it's as because of my love of the moving image, it's such a creative piece of work and great drama, and it's beautifully put together. Really.
Well,
is.
I'm going as we I do with all my guests. I'm going to ask you. Sadly, our time is running out, to finish with a piece of music of your choice. I wonder what you'd go for and why.
Oh, I wondered if you might ask something like this, and I've got a lot in my mind. There are stories attached to all of them, but I think I'll stick with Queen and The Show Must Go On.
Ah, true.
Because, well, you know, when you think about being an only child, being a teacher, being in the classroom, directing people. They're all sort of one-man bands, in a sense. Yeah. And the show, you can't stand in front of a class of kids and not get on with it. And it's absolutely 100%. The show must go on.
Well, so your life is one big act, Roland. That's marvellous.
You can meet the real me in my book. Yes, okay.
Well, it just remains for me to say thank you so much, Roland, for telling us about just some of your experiences in the performing arts and more, and best wishes with your book and new projects.
You.
So thanks so much for chatting, and it's goodbye for now, as we go over to Queen.
Spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know the score. On and on, does anybody know what we are looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime behind the curtain.
That was The Show Must Go On by Queen. It's now over to Fran Frank.
Hi there. Are you sitting comfortably? And do you feel ready for this month's general knowledge questions? Again, there will be 10 questions together with 3 possible answers. I have tried to include a variety of topics, so let's start with question 1. What was the name of the 1988 comedy in which Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger played mismatched siblings? Was it A, Twins, B, O Brother Where Art Thou, or C, Big Brother? Question 2. Who, according to the song and film of the same name, went up diddly up up and down diddly down down? Was it A, Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machine, B, Phileas Fogg, or C, Baron Munchausen? Question 3. The first vessel built of iron in 1843 was called the SS Great Britain. Where in the United Kingdom is it moored? Is it A, Greenwich, B, Southampton, or C, Bristol? Question 4. According to a 2024 survey, how many working Scotch whisky distilleries are there still operating in Scotland? Are there A, 83, B, 127, or C, 151? Question 5. What is the outermost layer of the earth called? Is it A, crust, B, skin, or C, carapace? Question 6. Which county in England contains the towns of Tring, Berkhamsted, and Letchworth? Is it A, Hampshire, B, Herefordshire, or C, Hertfordshire? Question 7. What word can describe the eye socket or the path of a celestial body around a planet? Is it A, ambit, B, orbit, or C, eclipse? Question 8. Balance, bar, relieve, and padishah are all terms from which type of performance art? Is it A, ballet, B, synchronized swimming, or C, breakdancing? Question 9. Caviar is principally made from the eggs of which fish? Are they A, herring, B, sturgeon, or C, trout? Question 10. Which Beatles hit features the lyric, "I am the Eggman, they are the Eggmen"? Is it A, I am the Walrus, B, Strawberry Fields Forever, or C, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds? Well, there are your questions for this edition. Hopefully you have already guessed some of the answers, but if not, listen again towards the end of the programme when I will reveal the correct ones.
Here is David Picton with his poem for this month.
A poem about having regrets, something we all have. Things we've done or said, but maybe things we regret that we haven't done or said. Perhaps it might be worth reflecting on this. Regrets. Regret for what you don't have, regret for what you've done. Regretfulness for all the things you thought at time were fun. Regrets for what you've said or not, for others that you've wronged, for kindness you have failed to give, for kisses you have longed. Regret regrets for own sake, for times when you were hurt, the loves you've lost along the way, the pain that they assert. Regret's a bugger, really. It drains a vital force. It dines on insecurity. Through veins it runs its course. In your guts it churns away, sends chills along your spine. Regretful flavours linger on and happiness malign. Regret's a poisoned chalice, a saw with rusted teeth, a snake in aortic cavern that offers no relief. It drinks your burning teardrops, it shades each day with cloud. Regret's a nightmare of the day you wear as weighted shroud. No regret, rien, it said, but this you cannot do. It's in the very steps you walk, without them you're not you. Worst of all, regrets in life are things you've left undone. The things still on your bucket list, the things that time's outrun.
Thank you, David. So beautifully encapsulated. And now a story from Norma Orty.
A Stray. Following an interview with a receiving officer at the workhouse, Thomas Brown and his wife Mary were approved for entry into the Surrey workhouse, named The Firs. Mary was carrying their young son, who was grisly and miserable. "He is hungry," said Thomas. "We will get an evening meal tonight at the workhouse. The master told me." Mary hushed the child and observed that he would be more miserable when they were split up and in separate buildings, let alone separate beds. "So will I, dearest," remarked her husband, "but what else could we do?" Within a few days, their lives had changed from happy and safe to desperate. Previously, they had been living in a flat over a grocer's shop, in fact, the village's only shop. Thomas and Mary had both worked hard in the shop and were well liked by everyone. Then they were tricked out of their business and their home by a scheming shark of a man. They had been gullible, and he had robbed them and turned them out into the cold with their child. In despair, they went to the vicar. He advised them to overcome their feelings of disgrace and apply for a room at the workhouse. He said it would be hard work for their keep, but hopefully, when the scheming man came before the magistrates, they should be fully reimbursed. Their few clothes were in two bags. The Firs was just on the other side of the village, a very big building housing 500 men, women and children, who were known as waifs and strays. In charge were a hard-looking couple called the master and the mistress. They had a staff who were supported by the inmates themselves. Thomas was quite well educated, and the master put him to work in the office. The vicar had recommended him. Mary was put into the laundry, where she could keep her baby within sight all day, while she washed the inmates' and the staff's clothing and sheets. Once a week, the family would be allowed to go out together when they walked to the Sunday service. After the service, they would meet with the vicar and get the latest news. The man who had robbed them was to appear in the following month, and Thomas would give evidence. They adjusted to their new life. They were clothed and fed, albeit with hand-me-downs, and fed mostly gruel and stews with rough bread, but occasionally some fruit was dropped off by a farmer and shared among the inmates. They were protected under the new laws, and better off than in some workhouses, which were mismanaged with cruel people in charge. After 3 months, they were called to the office, where they found the vicar with the master. That bad man has been tried, found guilty, and imprisoned, and your money and belongings were all recovered. The vicar added that the landlord wanted them back in the flat and the shop as soon as possible. The master released them immediately, and the vicar gave them a lift in his newfangled Austin car. The child was thrilled. "We will miss you all," said the mistress, "but we are delighted that your lives are coming right again, and all will go well." "We thank you," replied Mary, "and we're grateful that you took us in when we were just another family of waifs and strays in need of help."
A quick historical aside. Workhouses in the UK officially closed in 1930 under the Local Government Act 1929, but many soldiered on under less Dickensian names like public assistance institutions, and some even became hospitals. Others remained shelters for the homeless. The Camberwell workhouse stayed open until 1985, proof, if ever you needed it, that some traditions die hard. And now for this month's book review, with Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been looking at Tracy Chevalier's Burning Bright, by the author of The Girl with the Pearl Earring, and again, based on sort of history, an artistic history, and a character this time, Blake. It's such a sweet story. There's horrible things going on, but that's what life's like. It's set in London in the 1700s. It incorporates tragedy, laughter, love, kindness, everything you wish for in a story about daily life, but set in the gloomy time of the 1700s with the threat of the French Revolution in the background.
You kind of summed it all up there, Mary. There's not much left for me to say, but yes. So this is one of these sort of books where they have some real history and then it's mixed with fiction. So we have William Blake and his wife Kate, who lived in a place called Hercules Mansions in Lambeth. That's real, and they're quite young at the time of this. This is 1792, so just after the French Revolution. And then a whole load of fictional characters are then introduced as well, mainly a family. They're called the Calloways. They come from Dorset, and they come to work at a sort of circus. The father's a carpenter, and he brings his wife and his son and his daughter. And they, very much sort of from a little village in Dorset, and they come to London, this extraordinary time in London's history. And they mix with all the local kind of London people, and they have various adventures. It's mostly about the teenage children, and they get to know the Blakes. And it's all rather cleverly done because it's all interweaved with William Blake's work and his poetry and his art. And that's introduced alongside this just lovely, as you say, story about these Dorset people arriving in London and what they experience.
And of course, life in London and any big cities at the time was fairly horrendous if you were poor. And I think that's very well pictured and discussed for the children, particularly, who see all aspects of it. They see an old friend, they see characters who have money, people who would like to have money, people who have absolutely nothing and there's not a lot to sell. All those things that impinge on these young people's growing life, really. They have older siblings. There's a tragedy in that one of the siblings of one of the families who's killed in an accident before the story starts. So it's all those woes but joys that they bring and how they view the city. And of course, in a man's world, which even more was then, the father is safe because he has employment. He's a tradesman, a craftsman, so he will always have work. But it's the families and getting to know other women, which is always difficult for ladies. And getting to know women who are in the same class in theory, but in actual fact are from different worlds, and it's trying to draw those worlds together, which is seen through the children more than anything at all, and meeting Mr. Blake, which is a highlight of all their lives, and the circus involvement. It's just so sweet. I really enjoyed it, really enjoyed it, and I'd do it again. I haven't read Tracy's Valley before, but I would read another one because it's so well put together.
Right, so if you are interested in history, social history particularly, this is a lovely way to learn about it because she's done a huge amount of research and she sets her story in absolutely the way London was. There's this marvellous little passage where it's actually William Blake's mother's funeral, and they join the kind of funeral cortege, and it goes from Soho all the way through St. Giles, down High Holborn to Spitalfields. And, you know, that's an area of London I know very well, because whenever I go there, I stay there. And it's just so interesting to read what it was like. Totally different. And it's not that long ago, only three lifetimes ago, really. And it's just the progress we've made is, of course, enormous, but it's fascinating stuff.
And even in our recent history, those areas have risen to class and gone back and risen again. So London is a changing city all the time, and class changes and intermingles. And that's the big thing about this story. Class is there, even though it's at low class and different levels within low class. It's really interesting.
If you'd like to read along with us in September next month, we're going to be looking at a work of non-fiction. This is a book that's very popular at the moment, winning all kinds of awards and things. It's called Raising Hair, and it's by Chloe Dalton. So for September, Mary and I are going to be reading Raising Hair by Chloe Dalton.
Mary and Stephen have just discussed the book Burning Bright by Tracy Chevalier. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and downloadable audiobook. Jeannie Lloyd-Jacob is next with another episode of This and That. It was a pleasant July morning. A little overcast, perhaps, but the sun was making an appearance every now and then. I was pleased to find that after the past few days of very hot weather, the temperature had cooled considerably. A perfect day for an adventure, I thought. I had packed my rucksack with everything I thought I could possibly need for a whole day out. I toyed with the idea of packing my waterproof, but after consulting Alexa, who said,
"No rain is expected today,"
I left it hanging up. I had arranged to meet my friend Anne at Tynmouth Railway Station at 9:30 that morning. Cutting it a bit fine, it was already 9:25 when I grabbed my hat and cane, closed my front door behind me, descended the stairs and skipped off to the railway station, which fortunately is only a 5-minute walk away. Anne was already at the station when I arrived, and after purchasing our tickets, we sat on the platform and waited for our train to Torquay. We chatted and laughed at the amount of time we had both spent that morning in trying to find the perfect outfit to wear for the day. Of course, this is an impossible task, and one really shouldn't worry about it. But I was a bit worried when Anne told me that she had packed a waterproof after checking the weather forecast. Oh. From Torquay Station, we walked down to the seafront, crossed the road, and walked along the promenade towards Torquay Marina. As we walked, I noticed we hadn't seen any sunshine for a while, and the sky was becoming more and more ominous. We wondered at the wisdom of continuing with our plan, but walked on anyway. At the marina, we joined a long queue, which seemed to take ages to move, but eventually it did, and we were soon at the kiosk
asking for 2 return tickets for the boat to Brixham. This is a trip I have been wanting to do for some time, and when it came up in conversation, it turns out that it is something that Anne has been wanting to do too. And so we hatched a plan. After purchasing our tickets for the boat, we had a bit of a walk to take around the marina to where the boat was moored. We hadn't gone very far when I started to feel a few drops of rain. Hopes of it being just a light shower were suddenly dashed as the heavens opened and down it came. On top of this, out of nowhere it seemed, a sudden violent gust of wind blew up, nearly taking us off our feet. We ran for cover under a nearby tree, where several other people had taken shelter, not that it was offering much. Anne wrestled with her waterproof, battling against the wind to put it on, and not long after she had succeeded, the wind died, the rain abated, and the sun came out. Feeling very relieved, we stepped out from under the tree and hurried off to find our boat, which would be departing soon. The boat to Brixham was larger than I had expected, and one had the option of sitting inside or out. We thought it wise to sit inside. Once free of her moorings, the boat moved off, and we were soon out of the harbour, heading down the coast towards Brixham. The skipper gave us some running commentary and pointed out various places of interest along the coast as we passed them, entertaining us with the odd amusing tale as we went along. Some 30 minutes later, we were approaching the port of Brixham. The skipper pointed out an historic sailing boat moored in the harbour called Pilgrim. She had been built in Brixham in 1895. Wow, that's quite old. We had arranged to meet our friend Peter, who lives in Brixham, and as we disembarked, there he was, waiting for us on the quayside with Henry, his border collie dog. We all agreed that a cup of coffee was in order, and so Peter led us off to a small cafe on the waterfront. I knew that Peter was involved in some sort of historic boat restoration in Brixham and naturally assumed it must be the Pilgrim. But no, it wasn't. Peter's boat is called Vigilance. As we left the cafe, Peter proudly pointed out Vigilance, moored in the harbour, right next door to Pilgrim. Would we like to go aboard the Vigilance? Peter asked. Yes, we would, we said, and followed Peter down the jetty and climbed aboard. We stood on the wooden deck and admired. Peter told us that the Vigilance is a gaff-rigged ketch, as is the Pilgrim, which I'm sure means something to a mariner. In fact, the Vigilance, launched in 1926, was the last sailing trawler to be built in Brixham. Since then, she's had quite a varied career, being passed from one owner to another, and was eventually brought back to her birthplace by a preservation company in 1997. She is now owned by a registered charity, Vigilance of Brixham CIO, and is entirely run and sailed by volunteers. She has been out of service for the past 2 years whilst undergoing some major restoration. Work is currently being carried out to her interior to remove certain modern features that have been added over the years, thus returning her to her more authentic self. Vigilance is scheduled to be back in service next year and will be launched at her centenary. She will then be used again to take visitors out on sailing trips and also as an educational resource to show what trawling was like in the early 1900s. The three of us, deciding that it must be lunchtime, climbed down from the vigilance, collected a very patient Henry, who had been tied up on the jetty, and all scampered off to the pub. Up a narrow side street, not far from the quay, we found the Oldie Woldie New Quay Inn, serving the usual pub grub. After a long and leisurely lunch, we walked up the hill to Peter's place for a cup of tea and to meet his chickens. It was soon time to walk back down the hill to catch the last boat back to Torquay at 5 p.m. Apart from the brief downpour earlier that morning, the weather had stayed fine for the rest of the day, and we were now sailing back to Torquay in brilliant sunshine. This time we decided to sit upstairs, believing it safe to expose ourselves to the elements. Thankfully, the skipper's commentary on the way back was different from the one we had heard earlier, including his jokes. We were both feeling quite weary, in a pleasant kind of way, as we walked back from the marina along the seafront to Torquay train station. As we sat on the platform, waiting for our train back to Tynmouth, we both reflected on what a lovely day we'd had, marred ever so slightly by the fact that we now needed a public convenience and the one on the station was locked, which was in fact a public inconvenience.
That sounded like a very enjoyable trip to Brixham, though perhaps less so for anyone needing the train station facilities. It's over to Sue Smallwood.
This is a poem written by Annie White, and Annie has very kindly allowed me to use it to read out to all of you. I've bought myself a scooter, I never thought I would, so you better watch your back if you're in the neighbourhood. Because there's so much to remember, and I'm a bit of a numpty. As I career along the pavement, I feel like Humpty Dumpty must have felt in that moment as he balanced on the wall when he started to wobble just before his great fall. You just don't realise when you can walk free as the breeze how many of the pavements slope at 20 degrees. So I lurch to the left and I slide to the right. Thank goodness my seatbelt is fastened up tight. The machine can't cope with curbs, so if I want to cross the road, I have to drive for miles with my brain in lookout mode until I find a place where the path slopes gently down. You soon get to know where those places are in town. And then there's the dilemma about where I belong. 'Cause even though I'm in the right, I feel I'm in the wrong. I'm supposed to ride on pavements, but people stop and glare. And I just know that they're thinking the road is over there. When I'm forced into the road, 'cause the pavement's full of fans, drivers beat their horns and make rude gestures with their hands. I feel full of optimism as I set out on my trip. With the wind in my hair and all that power in my grip. But the feeling doesn't last, though I get there in a jiff, 'cause I forgot to put my gloves on and my hands are frozen stiff. My daughter said to me, "Have you given it a name yet?" Well, that was a no-brainer. I just had to call it Jet. From 0 to 4 miles an hour in under a minute. If I had to race a snail, there'd be very little in it. It's a little bit slower if you're going up a hill, but I can come and go of my own free will, and for that I'm truly grateful. It's worth more than words can say. So I've bought myself a scooter, and the scooter's here to stay.
We now have Viv Wilson with another episode of One Foot in the Past. This time, she will be talking about the life of John George Smith, the first Baronet of Tynmouth.
As a resident within Teignbridge, if you were asked to name the first Baronet of Teignmouth, what would your answer be? That question is sure to stump all but serious students of military history, yet my story begins on a very human level. Let me take you to the Den at Teignmouth, where the bowling green is a prominent feature. Let's imagine that you are walking along the path heading towards the pier with the bowling green on your left. Next to the path, a granite block is set in a small memorial feature, and that tablet acknowledges the life and service to his country of one John George Smith, VC. Although his name is spelled with a Y, not an I, it was apparently always expressed as Smith, not Smythe. Now, right away, it needs to be said that this is the only VC commemorative tablet dedicated to a local-born person within the Teignbridge area to date. Our hero was born in a house named Greenmount on Ferndale Road, Teignmouth, a quiet, elegant part of the town in 1893. His father was a civil servant with the Indian government. The boy was known as Jackie, such a humble name for a person who would see serious action in three conflicts. Yes, three conflicts. He attended Dragon School, Repton, before enrolling at Sandhurst Military College. He was commissioned as second lieutenant in the British Indian Army in 1912, and the next year entered the 15th Ludhiana Sikhs Company. Just after the start of World War I, he was promoted to lieutenant. Now, most people know how Lawrence of Arabia learned to blend in with local men by adopting their garb. And similarly, John, as I shall refer to him from now on, took to wearing a turban while serving with this company of Sikhs. In May 1915, they were positioned on the border between France and Belgium. After taking the enemy trenches, a battalion of British soldiers trying to take the German lines were cut off by a counterattack. Unbelievably, 10 men in John's company volunteered to convey 96 bombs across no man's land to position them just 20 yards from the enemy. 8 of those men were killed or injured during 2 failed attempts. John, then aged 21, set off with the 2 remaining Sikhs to drag the crates of explosives across open ground, swim through a stream with the crates, and all the while continuous bombardment by rifles, machine guns, howitzers, and flying shrapnel. His uniform was riddled with bullet holes, yet miraculously he was uninjured. It is hard to imagine the horror of it. The following month, he was awarded a VC, which is our country's highest award for bravery in combat. During the First War, some 415 Victoria Crosses were awarded. Later, John was also awarded the Russian Order of St. John. He was promoted to captain in 1916 and continued his war service in Egypt and on the Northwest frontier. By September, he was Brigade Major of the 43rd Indian Brigade, when a serious situation arose in Waziristan, a region of Pakistan, where the enemy had attacked a convoy. His gallantry and initiative was rewarded with a military cross. He returned to England, taking up a post at the Staff College, Camberley, where he rubbed shoulders with people who would later achieve high command. His career was fast-tracked, and by 1936 he was a lieutenant colonel. In February 1940, he was in command of the 127th Infantry, which was to form part of the British Expeditionary Force. After being evacuated from Dunkirk, within a short time he was back out east again, this time in Burma. But now things did not go well for John, who was given command of the 17th Indian Infantry Division. He took a decision that jeopardised the campaign and was sacked on the spot by the Commander-in-Chief of India. It appears that his health had been causing him some problems and he had not fully recovered from surgery on a, shall we say, a particularly tender part of his anatomy. Nearly 40 years later, he wrote a book called Milestones, explaining his side of the issue, which had been caused by his recommendation being overlooked. What on earth would a man like John do after the war? Well, he took to politics as a Conservative and defeated the sitting Labour MP for Norwood. In 1956, he was made a baronet, so that his full title became the Right Honourable Sir John George Smith, V.C., M.C., 1st Baronet of Tynmouth in the County of Devon. He didn't rest on his laurels either. He was also an author, playwright, journalist and broadcaster. His love of cats led him to writing three books about them before his death at the age of 90. He was cremated at Golders Green, and his Victoria Cross is displayed at the Imperial War Museum. So, dear listeners, next time you are on Tynmouth's Den, spare a thought for this extraordinary man who lived an ultra-extraordinary life, yet was born in dear old Tynmouth.
It's time for those quiz answers with Fran Frank.
Are you still sitting comfortably? Then here are the answers to this month's quiz questions. Question 1. What was the name of the 1988 comedy in which Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger played mismatched siblings? The answer was A. Twins. Question 2. Who, according to the song and film of the same name, went up diddly up and down diddly down? It was A. Those magnificent men in their flying machine. Question 3. The first vessel built of iron in 1843 was called the SS Great Britain. Where in the United Kingdom is it moored? The answer was C. Bristol. Question 4. According to a 2024 survey, how many working Scotch whisky distilleries are there still operating in Scotland? The answer was C. 151. Although there could be others around the world, I'm sure there will be. Question 5. What is the outermost layer of the earth called? The answer was A. Crust. Question 6. Which county in England contains the towns of Tring, Berkhamsted and Letchworth? The answer was C. Hertfordshire. Question 7. What word can describe the eye socket or the path of a celestial body around a planet? And the answer was B. Orbit. Question 8. Balance, bar, relieve and padishah are all terms from which type of performance art? The terms relate to A. Ballet. Question 9. Caviar is principally made from the eggs of which fish? The answer was B. Sturgeon. And finally, question 10. Which Beatles hit features the lyric, "I am the Eggman, they are the Eggmen"? It was, of course, A. I am the Walrus. Well, that's it for another month. I hope you enjoyed the selection this time and managed to get lots of correct answers. I'll go back to my books and see what topics I can find for next month's general knowledge quiz. Bye for now.
We now have an announcement about the VIP book group at Dawlish Library.
Hello there. My name is Miggy and I'd like to tell you a bit about Dawlish Library's book group for visually impaired people. We are a small group which meets once a month to enable each member to take home a number of audiobooks from a selection provided by the library. At each meeting, our volunteers read out the description of each book, and group members can decide whether that book is of interest to them. If so, they borrow it at no charge. We have a cup of tea and a biscuit in the middle of the session, and then there's an opportunity to hear about and borrow some of last month's returned books. We are a friendly bunch, and we would love to welcome some new members. Our current members come from both Dawlish and Tynmouth, but anyone in the surrounding area is welcome to join us. If you'd like to know more, just contact Dawlish Library on 01626 862 529 or drop into chat to our helpful library staff. Thanks for listening.
David Quay is up next with a piece intriguingly titled Hold Very Tight, Please. Let's find out why.
Hold Very Tight, Please. Hello, I'm David. And you may remember that I spoke about the golden age of rail travel a little while ago. Well, now I'd like to turn my attention to buses, and in particular to London buses, as that's where I'm from. I'm sure that much of what I'm going to talk about applies equally to other corporation services, here, for example, with Devon General. I've entitled this, Hold Very Tight, Please. Because that's what the conductor, yes indeed the conductor in those days, bedecked in a peak cap, invariably said as we were about to pull away. Only 5 standing passengers, please. Move down inside. And some passengers were even standing on the open platform at the back, giving testimony to the advert of hop on a bus at either traffic jams or traffic lights. And so we're off. What would health and safety say today? When I first started travelling on buses and the push bell or the bell strip had been rung by the conductor, I didn't understand him when he came along saying, "In my wee wees," or so it seemed to me. I soon came to realise that he was asking for any more fares, please. And the passenger, having paid, was given a ticker tape ticket from his Gibson machine, or the correctly priced coloured ticket from his rack, and the change given and received and placed in a leather pouch. And you remember the ticket was placed in a machine and you had a bell punch and the hole was made in the ticket with a sound. Ah, we've arrived at a request stop and a lady with a child in a pushchair has got on and placed the infant carriage in the space by the stairs, by permission of the conductor, as the notice says. Oh, and yes, an inspector's also got on to examine tickets. This was quite a common experience in those days. And you know, a myriad of other memories are coming back to me now. On a double-decker, you could only smoke upstairs, and there were even small metal places where you could stub out your cigarette. Some buses even had a sign, "No spitting." On London buses, when the conductor switched on the lights at dusk, he also pulled down a brown concertina-like blind by the driver so that the latter wouldn't be blinded by the interior lights. And also, do you remember those half gloves worn by conductors with the finger ends cut off? Yes, used in wintry or cold conditions. I can barely remember the trams. Well, they finished in London in 1952. But I recall quite vividly the trolley buses, so quiet and green, and they were really ahead of their time. Oh, and yes, do you remember when their poles came adrift from the wires and were sent splaying in all directions? What a palaver that was, as the conductor essayed to connect pole to wire by means of a long bamboo pole carried in the undercarriage of every trolley bus. Strange to say, I recall both the design and the smell of the fabric of those buses, indeed of any bus. It was also on the side of these trolley buses and also on the side of the later petrol and diesel buses that I can remember the adverts those long adverts along the side of the bus. I'm sure you will remember them too. But they were like a social commentary on the 50s and the early 60s. Well now, let me just test you. Do you remember these adverts? Ah, Bisto. There's more hops in Ben Truman. Senior service, a satisfy. Players, please. Omo adds brightness. Vernon's, pools. Cross and Blackwell, baked beans. And memorably, Guinness is good for you, with that very big pelican at the end of the advertisement. What do you do? What? I think I've reached my destination now. It's a request stop, so I'll ring the bell to signal to the driver that I want to get off. And you know what? I'm going to place my ticket in the metal box marked Used Tickets. And, of course, I'll hold very tight. Yes, very tight indeed. I can tell you that at my age now, that's more important than ever. Now then, oh yes, I've reached the stop. Better get off very carefully from my London omnibus.
I suspect that one stirred a few fond, or perhaps bumpy, memories. At David's request, here's the song A Transport of Delight by Flanders and Swann.
Some people like a motorbike, some say a tram for me, or for Bonnie, or me Lonnie. They'd lay them down and deem such means of locomotion seem rather dull to us, the driver and conductor of a London omnibus. Hold very tight, please, ting ting. Hold very tight, please, ting ting. When you are lost in London and you don't know where you are, you'll hear my voice a-calling both further down the car. And very soon you'll find yourself inside the terminus in a London Transport diesel engine 97 horsepower omnibus. Along the Queen's Great Highway, I drive my merry load at 20 miles per hour in the middle of the road. We like to drive in convoys, we're most gregarious. The big six-wheeler scarlet painted a London Transport diesel engine 97 horsepower omnibus. Earth has not anything to show more fair.
Mind the stairs, lady.
Mind the stairs.
Mind the stairs.
Earth has not anything to show more fair.
Any more fair,
any more fair, any more fair, any more fair, any more fair. When cabbies try to pass me before they overtakes, I sticks me flipping hand out and I jams on all me brakes. Them jackal taxi drivers can only swear and cuss behind that monarch of the road, observer of the highway code,
that big six-wheeler,
scarlet painted,
London Transport
diesel engine,
97 horsepower omnibus.
I stops when I'm requested, although it spoils the ride, so we can shout,
get out of it, we're full right up inside. We don't ask much for wages, we only want fair shares. So cut down all the stages and stick up all the fares. If tickets cost £1 a piece, why should you make a fuss? It's worth it just to ride inside.
30 foot long by 10 foot wide.
Inside that monarch of the road.
Observer of the highway code.
That big six-wheeler scarlet painted London Transport diesel engine. 97 horsepower. 97 horsepower omnibus. Hold very tight, please.
Thanks go to John Townsend and his guest Roland Burrows, Fran Frank, David Picton, Norma Orty, Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Jeannie Lloyd-Jacob, Sue Smallwood, Viv Wilson, Miggy Picton, and David Quay. Thanks also to David Picton for helping me with the copy and dispatch, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor and edited by Stephen Taylor.